Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of Outlaw Radio USA, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. The following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. True Crime Uncensored, I am the, let me look, legendary Burl Bear. The man in Howard Lapidus' chair isn't Howard Lapidus because he can't sit down. He had a little surgery on his tuchus, but he'll be all right. Frank C. Girardo Jr., brilliant journalist and co-author with Ken Jarrell and some other guy, of Betrayal in Blue, the shocking memoir of the scandal that rocked the NYPD.
Some other guy would be Burl Bear.
That's me, yes, I'm afraid so.
The legendary, the one and only true crime Edgar Award-winning author.
Yeah, I love it when you talk like that. Ken Jarrell is with us, too, on the phone. Hey, Ken, nice to have you.
I'm here, guys.
Hey, Ken.
We had fun the other night. We were on Dan Zapansky's show. And
Trainer.
Mark C.G. Boyer, our fact checker, is here, so if we say anything wrong, he'll correct us. And as good as we were on Dan Zapansky's show, we'll be better on mine.
And do you know why that is, Burl?
Because it's a shorter show and we talk faster.
No, because we're going to be discussing your favorite all-time subject.
Myself.
Correct.
And Ken Jarrell. It's really Ken's story. It's just that Frank and I helped him tell his story. And it's a hell of a story. I got to ask Ken the question, which is part of the reason we do the show. Do you ever look back on your life and go, God, did I screw it up?
Yeah, every day since this all started up all over again.
Yeah, you had a couple of years or a few decades of respite from feelings of overwhelming guilt and shame. And then it all came back.
I was able to move on there for a little while, and then it all got brought up again with the documentary, and that brought the book back to the forefront for me, and here we are again.
Yeah, it just keeps going around in a circle.
It's harder on my wife.
I bet it is.
All the time.
You know, I worry about you because I figure one of these days she's just going to pop and slug you. Or maybe she already has.
I got to sleep in a separate room and lock the door.
Still got a Rottweiler?
Big Mastiffs now.
Oh, God, those are great. My daughter had three of them. At the beginning of the book, we're actually on the cover of the book. This is the first time I've actually seen the book. Because Frank brought me a copy. It says, the shocking memoir of the scandal that rocked the NYPD. It's not the only scandal that's rocked the NYPD. I mean, even when Ken was a cop in New York.
It's the only memoir, though.
Yes, it is the only memoir. Ken was a nice kid, a nice Catholic boy, married to a nice Jewish girl, you know, living...
My sympathies.
You know why Jewish men die before their wives, don't you?
Because they want to.
Damn right. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Ken's story. Ken marries this lovely, very good-looking woman. She still is, too, boy. And he's got a couple great kids and a mastiff. What more could a man want? And when he was a young guy, he becomes a cop. Little did he know he'd also become a criminal. How long did it take, Ken?
Depends on the degree of the crime.
Let's go from petty to, like the first time, it didn't seem like much.
The first time I took money, I was in for 7 years. I was practically stuck right into my hand.
So you're sitting in a squad car, and your partner turns to you and hands you $100.
Yep. Just pulled it out of his pocket, goes, here, this is for you.
And you go, why me? Why my lucky day?
I was like, what is this for? Where is that from? I had no idea. It came out of the blue to me. And if I had any brains at the time, I would have said no and went in another direction. But unfortunately, I did not see all the bad roads down in the future.
I mean, if $100 is good, Ken, isn't 200 better?
That's all. He took 800 and only gave me 100. I found out.
Go beat the crap out of him.
7 years later, when he testified at the Mullen Commission, he testified to taking $800 from that scene.
And he gave you 100. Some partner, that is. Hell.
Exactly. So much for a piece of rice for all of us.
Yeah.
12%.
Yeah.
Well, that's, he was just the getaway driver. Or was he driving?
He was driving.
So, from having read this brilliant book,
that's a subjective opinion.
Okay.
Which part? Having read it or the fact that it's brilliant?
Yes.
Well, the fact that he can read is mind-numbingly incredible.
Actually, for people who are unaware of what's going on here, Frank, why don't you give them the background so I don't have to talk too much.
Okay. All right. So Ken Urell was a New York Police Department officer. He joined in the 70s and was stationed in Brooklyn in the 75, which was a notoriously rough district with a lot of crime, a lot of stuff going on there. His being there coincided with the rise of cocaine and also the rise of crack cocaine. Ken got involved with some nefarious characters, ended up leaving the police department, and after he left, he was arrested and involved in a pretty large cocaine distribution ring, turned into a federal case. All the while, he was keeping notes like a diary, and it's a pretty cool thing. He kind of put it away.
He's lucky they didn't find it when they raided his house.
Yeah.
Well, they found it. They threw it up in the air, not realizing what they found.
Yeah, but they got all excited.
They got excited
over the codes to a video game. They thought it was a secret code to his criminal empire.
That would open the books.
Yeah. But instead, they tossed the books.
Yeah, that's funny. There's this great documentary on that era and on Ken and his partner Mike Dowd and some of the other players that were involved, Baron Perez, Adam Diaz.
Chicky,
that'd be Henry Guevara. And you know, these guys are characters. They're just these, you watch this documentary and you feel like you're watching a combination of, you know, Goodfellas and maybe, I don't know.
Barney Miller.
Goodfellas and Barney. I like that combination.
Let's go with The Shield.
The Shield, right. Okay. But it's that sort of a thing when you watch this documentary. And so now, you know, Ken's got this memoir, a contemporary memoir of that era. He got to Burl, and Burl came to me, and we kind of put it all together. We added some history of the New York Police Department and the various scandals that have happened there. We talked again to some of the players, including Baron Perez and Chicky Guevara and Adam Diaz. Adam Diaz is this...
I'd love to do Adam Diaz's book.
Well, I mean, that guy's got to have a great book in him. They call him Blondie.
He is interesting.
They call him Blondie, and he's, you know, a tiny little guy who is a Dominican coke dealer, and, you know... That really kind of the Tony Montana of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and the Bronx for at least a few years. It's quite a story. And, you know, Ken's narrative ties this whole thing together just so beautifully. And then, you know, the fact that these guys were not, you know, wanted to talk about that era too, just helped the book. And it's such a great companion to the documentary because... You see, Ken's memoir really takes you behind the scenes. It talks to stuff that you have these questions when you watch the documentary. But
the documentary is called The 7-5. They've been showing it a lot on Showtime, and it was originally on Sundance Channel.
Yes, that is the documentary. And you know, I urge you to watch it, and I urge you to, you know, if you're listening, to buy our book. It's called Betrayal in Blue.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful idea. In fact, I would suggest with the holidays coming up, what could be more in the Christmas spirit?
I'll have a
stocking stuffer about cops selling coke.
Elvis.
I love it.
Blue Christmas.
Yeah.
We'd probably be able to sell the book better if we gave away a gram of coke with it.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and I think I'll order about 24 copies of the book right now.
I think you'll do better if you put marijuana in it.
Oh, well, that's already legal.
Yeah, but you'll do better. More, you have a larger audience.
Larger audience. Well, but
they might fall asleep before they get
before they read it. Yeah.
What do you care? As long as they pay.
They'll eat the pages.
As long as they pay, why would you care?
It's the first time I've actually seen the book, which is a nice, feels like a good book.
Hey, I didn't know that the texture of the paper made a difference, but
it does.
You say so.
Yeah.
So I got to ask Ken. So So Ken, you know, we in the book we talk to your friends and coworkers and stuff like that. Have you heard back from any of them since we published it?
I've recently spoken probably three times already with Chicky, and actually Baron texted me a couple of times today. We texted back and forth.
So what's their opinion?
Chicky hasn't gotten the book yet. He's waiting for it either to be downloaded for free on the internet on some torrent site, almost out of money, or he's waiting for an autographed copy from us.
That we can do.
He's not ready yet, but I have sent him a picture of, I think it was chapter 11 that was entitled Chicky.
Chicky, yep. Chicky gets his own chapter.
Have you spoken to Michael?
No, I have not spoken to Michael since our last event together, which was probably over a year ago.
So he doesn't drop by unannounced.
No, he does not.
Yeah. Probably just as well.
What's he up to these days?
Honestly, I don't know. He's jet setting all over the place. Every time someone on Twitter writes me, they're telling him Mike's over here, Mike's over there.
He's an exploiter.
So one of the other great things that we were able to do with this book is Dory, Ken's wife. Talked a lot and talked, extensively about this period of her life from, marrying Ken, living through all of this, going through the arrest. And it really, I think, brings the story together from a woman's perspective that you might not get with a bunch of cops in the squad car. And Dory is great. She really, I think, keeps Ken grounded and keeps our story moving along. And I sure was happy to be able to talk to her and get her involved. I'm wondering, Ken, what was Dory's reaction to the book now that it's out?
She's sort of happy for me because she knows I wanted to, do this for a very long time. It's hard for her to digest it all because there's a lot of things that she has not known about. I kept her in the dark all these years, and when the documentary came out, I had to tell her about things that I didn't want to tell her about. And, there's parts in there that she just doesn't want to relive, even though, she's glad it's finally a project that I've completed, that's been on the back burner for 20-something years.
Well, what's in your favor, Ken, is the fact that some of the stuff that she might really be pissed off about was, like, over 20-some years ago. And that's like...
Try explaining that to an emotional...
You go, honey, it's been two decades since then. Those people are either dead or grandmothers.
For her to find out about these things now, it means it happening to her now.
Oh, God.
Even though it was, you know...
Why can't a woman be more like a man?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, you're blessed that she's stuck with you as long as she has.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a lucky man.
And the book really benefits from, a lot of Dory's insight and experience. And we were blessed that she participated with us.
So, yeah, she could have told us all to go to hell.
Yeah, she really could have, it wouldn't have been the book that it is. And I think that, the memoir, and so Ken's memoir, takes you through his youth in Queens, his joining the NYPD, his getting into the rookie assignment in a Brooklyn district, and then ending up in the 7-5 precinct, and Ken tells his story through his eyes. But the fact that we were able to talk to these other people was great, and the era was so fascinating, wasn't it, Burl?
I think I remember it. I spent most of it looking into a mirror, above the mirror, actually, looking down.
Look down at the mirror.
Yeah, yeah. But I had a wonderful time, actually.
Well, that explains a lot,
Now, people tend to look back at my 60s, which I term the era of my Paisley vacation. As they say, if you think you remember it, you weren't there.
Well, as fascinating it is on how two people write a book with somebody else telling them a story, why don't we hear some of the story?
All right.
I'd actually like Ken to talk about, partnering with Dowd being out on the street and, you know, the days after that $100 exchanged hands in the squad car?
When I first hooked up with Mike, I actually, we were both without partners and we kept getting thrown in the car together. And Mike had a reputation that was not the stellar cop reputation, and I actually didn't want to be with him. There was no objecting to it. No matter what I said, they kept sticking us in a car together, and eventually we decided to make it a legit thing and become steady partners. And we hooked up, had an emotional connection between being married at the same time and having children at the same time, so...
Became buddies.
Yeah, exactly. We became really buddies before we became partners, just by talking. And as soon as we became steady partners, he started talking about money in the precinct and his past episodes where he crossed the blue line from cop to criminal. He wanted to see my reaction to it. And in that time in the police department, you don't go running off to internal affairs and say, so-and-so is doing criminal acts and doing things out of policy favor, because you want those guys to be there for you when you're in trouble, which is all the time, in that especially in that precinct.
Reminds me of Serpico.
Exactly. You know, at that time, this is 1987 when this is happening with Dowd, and Serpico, I must have seen it 50 times, so that's playing in your head. If I go tell on these guys, or Mike in particular, and the partners he was talking about.
And they said you have to get shot.
God forbid, if I'm in some situation where I need them, I'm getting shot in the face like Serpico did. So, of course no one's going to say anything. And then little by little, it becomes ingrained in you, and then he throws you that money, and it's that easy, and then the next time's easier and easier and easier, and the crimes go from, you know, a little burglary scene where I get $100 to eventually we're working for a major drug organization.
That's a good gig.
Yeah.
I mean, if it weren't for the fact that that was illegal, that was a great gig.
The cocaine business is an excellent business. Unfortunately, it's a criminal business.
Well, that's because there's so much money in it. You can't have all that wonderful corruption if it's legal.
There you go.
So at the height of you guys working for this, you know, cartel or this distribution ring, how much were you making?
$8,000 a week, every week, in cash, given to us in a brown paper bag, and...
Is that each?
It was easy. $8,000, and we split it. So we, after now, 20 years later, finding out how powerful
you underbid.
This organization was, the Diaz organization, we undersold ourselves. We should have been making a lot more money.
But still, when you figure out what the dollar was worth then... That was a hell of a lot of money.
Right. Oh, yeah. It'd be a hell of a lot of money now to make $8,000 a week.
Or $16,000 a month a person.
That's a good deal. I'll take that job.
Yeah.
It's a little high risk.
No,
but I got kind of diplomatic immunity if I'm a cop.
It was a little bump in pay over the regular police salary.
A little bump.
Yeah. How much was the regular pay for a cop in New York at that time?
We were probably making, without overtime, which was maybe $700 a week. $750 a week. No, and that's bi-weekly. We've got a bi-weekly check, so.
But that wasn't the only way you guys were scoring, right? I mean, there were other opportunities to make money above and beyond that $8,000.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you walk in on, and any crime scene you walk in on that is, where there's,
money or dope.
Money or dope. The money or dope just disappears, you know. And you got either the person who was there at the scene is already dead when you get there, so they're not complaining when you end up taking it, or you catch them in the criminal act and you don't arrest them, so they're just, thank goodness I'm not arrested, because if they get arrested, they're losing their money in dope anyway.
So and time.
Open, and we go on our way, and they don't say nothing. They're just happy not to be arrested.
And plus, you know, you can go back and do them again.
You write down that name and address on the back page of a memo book.
Uh-huh. Hey, it's been 6 weeks. Let's go get him again.
Confiscates for me and never notices.
Yeah, we had a cop like that in Seattle. We used to see he'd come down the street. I think it was Brooklyn Avenue and University Way. And that's where the drug dealers used to lean against the wall there by the university, selling pot and speed and acid. He'd shake down all the speed dealers with his speed. Didn't arrest him, just shake him down. They knew, here he comes. So they'd make sure they have plenty for him.
Better have a little bit extra there.
Yeah.
So there's a great scene in the book where you guys go out to a call of a dead body. And you're up in an apartment or a room of a condo, and there's money there, and Mike's got to get it out, and he's got to get it out in a way that nobody sees it. And how does he do that?
Yeah, well, this was a call of came over shots fired. So where it comes over is not normally a repetitive call where there's drugs and money and shooting. So it's in a residential area, so we know it's out of the ordinary, and most likely it was a stash house for drugs and or money. So we go racing over there before the unit that was assigned the job gets there. First one's there, and as soon as we get up to the front door, the door's partially open with a dead body blocking the doorway. The guy's shot in the head, and you hear people yelling from upstairs. We jump over the body, we clear the ground floor, we run upstairs, and while I'm checking on the people up there, Mike runs into a front bedroom where there's a safe and there's some heroin in the drawer. And as other cops are showing up on the scene, I go into the room with Dowd, and they start trying to take over the scene, and I close the door on one of these detectives who retired recently, within the last year, as a hero detective. There was a big write-up on in the paper about him. And I told him, we got this room, don't worry about it. And he backed out, and then Dowd grabs a couple of ounces of heroin, throws it in a paper bag, and normally he throws things down his pants because no one's going to check down his pants. And there were too many cops at the time, so when we're walking out of the room, he had it in a little brown lunch bag, and a boss is coming up the stairs, and there was a bunch of guns in the room, so we left the guns for this hero detective. And as we're exploring this banister, top of the stairway, there's a garbage pail, like an outdoor garbage pail, but it's in the house. So he takes the heroin, puts it down on top of the garbage pail, and we're going down the stairs as the boss is coming up. And as Dowd is passing the boss, he reaches back over the banister, grabs the heroin, and we go out the front door.
Now, yeah, you guys were moving coke, and heroin wasn't like one of the things that you were typically selling. So was it easy? How'd you get rid of it?
It was easy to get rid of it, but we did not know enough about the heroin trade where it came back in drips and drabs, and we were most likely ripped off.
Yeah, figures.
So there's this great scene where, you know, it's your first day in the 7-5. And, you know, there's this crusty old cop there, and he wants to, you know, extend the warmest greeting possible to you and your friend, Frank Essig. So what does he say?
This is pretty funny because it's like the hit line in the documentary. We had just finished our probationary period. We were working in the 7-7 precinct, and on the way home, we were assigned to the 7-5 precinct to start there the next day. So a day early, we're in civilian clothes, my buddy and I, and we walk in the front door of the 7-5 precinct, and we flash our tens. That's what our badge is. We call them tens. And we tell the guy, he's probably in his mid-30s, early 40s, and he's sitting there at the front desk. And we go, we're assigned to start here tomorrow. We'd just like to go find a locker. And the first words out of any cop's mouth from the 7-5, I hear, "Welcome to the land of fuck."
Right away, you knew you were in for something.
That's something that sticks with, you know, for the rest of your life. Here's this old-time cop, and we're two young 20-year-old kids walking in the front door of this badass precinct station house. And this guy's telling us, "Welcome to the land of fuck." And my buddy and I just looked at each other. We're like,
is he trying to tell us something?
Because we have experienced cops that were burnt out already in our probationary period in the 7-7. And we almost like, just shake it off. It's just another burnt out cop. No big deal. Welcome to the land of fuck. Okay, here we go. Land of fuck.
Wasn't that particular precinct at that time one of the murder capitals of the world?
The 7-5 in the mid-80s, it was like 85, 86, 87, had the highest number of murders in the country for like th- 3 years running.
Yeah, but the next year it only got the bronze. It kind of went down.
Exactly.
Hey, I got a question. I woke up this morning with bullfrogs on my mind, and then I thought to myself...
Did Jeremiah come
yeah.
see you?
Yeah, he did. If the ghetto is so poor, how are they making all this money with the drugs?
How are they making the money? Because you got people coming from all over the city coming in to buy the drugs from the drug dealers, and then they go back out and distribute it among the five boroughs.
Okay, so it's not that the poor people in the ghetto are buying it. It's the people in the suburbs are coming to the ghetto to buy it.
Exactly. It's not, you know, it's not the people really that are living there in the precinct buying the quantity. They're buying small amounts, but the big dealers are coming in to make the purchases and then removing it out of the county.
Yeah, it, I bumped into a former drug dealer from Boston. Said the same thing. He and his dad had a coke operation, and he said, then some white guy came and set me up in a safe house in the suburbs, then I really made money. So then he retired. It's nice work if you can retire.
Yeah, if you can get away with it and have no repercussions, it's great.
Hey, do you have any idea how much time Adam Diaz did in the slammer?
Diaz did, from what I've been told and from speaking to him, he did about 8 years, and then he got deported to DR.
But his now his time and his case is totally separate from yours, right?
Yeah, that was prior to he got arrested in like 1988. And we didn't get arrested until 1992.
So
he was in for like 4 years by the time we got arrested.
So now you left the police department in 88, right?
89.
In 89, and so you have this whole period of time between 89 and 92, and you're still working with Mike, right?
When I first retired, there was like a good 6 month, maybe 9 month period. I didn't associate with Dowd or anybody. I just got my life back on track. My wife went back to work, and I was sort of doing a Mr. Mom thing. And then Dowd was still doing his thing, selling cocaine. He became a cocaine dealer and still working as a cop and doing whatever he did on the job with different scams. And I had two other cops that were not involved with us, but I knew, who knew of what I had done with Dowd in the past, that wanted to start selling cocaine out on Long Island. And they came to me to make a connection with Dowd, and that's what I did. And that's how I became a cocaine dealer.
And then you and kids, you too, can follow that same path.
So this is a question I ask for a lot of
This is Mark Boyer, by the way, our fact checker.
I was wondering, what do you do with the money?
Let's say we enjoyed it.
Well, the answer I get most often is that you can't save it.
It's like you can't go down to the bank and deposit it in the bank. No, absolutely not.
Right.
I always figured that Adam probably came out all right. We can't figure out how much money that guy must have been making. You know, he was making a lot more than you were.
Paying us $8,000 a week. Yeah, he was doing a little bit better than
Yeah,
that.
And I'm sure
according,
that when he...
According to the documentary, he was making hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
So I mean, if he invested it wisely...
Right, got himself an annuity.
Yeah, sure, I'm sure he's doing fine selling cigars. Whatever the hell he's doing.
Well, that's really what he does. You know, you can follow Adam on Twitter, or you can follow Ken on Twitter, or even Ken's wife, Dory, or Burl, or me. But you know Adam.
Keep up with the cast of
keep up with the cast of characters.
Of former cops and drug dealers.
Yeah.
Hashtag
the 75.
#10URL.
Yeah.
Isn't that the name of his cigar company?
I believe it is called the 75. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
cigar,
I was gonna.
75. Yeah.
So I here's the thing about Adam. He's so charming. It just blows you away.
Even more charming than me.
Oh, that's
Burl, you know what? It's a close call between the two of you, but I'm gonna give this one to Adam.
Oh wow, he must really be good.
Adam
is a smart, intelligent businessman.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the business he got involved in was drugs and cocaine, but he's a very intelligent person, and he climbed up the ladder and ran a multi-million dollar business.
And he climbed up the ladder quickly. I mean, you know, as a teenager, he was doing business with Nicky Barnes, which is, that's not small potatoes. Nicky Barnes was Mr. Untouchable, you know, a top heroin dealer in, I guess, what, Washington, Washington Heights, maybe?
Washington Heights, yeah.
Yeah, in the 70s. And to, you know, to be at that level of dealership at that time, you know, Superfly, Shaft, Mr. Untouchable, Mr. Big, you know, that was quite a deal. And Adam, in his own way, was kind of a prince of the city, you know.
King of the New York streets.
I mean, he really was.
I'm getting into a different corrupt cop story, Prince of the City.
Yeah, I know, but I said Adam was kind of a prince of the city.
Yeah.
But right? I mean, you know, he had his motorcycle, he had his cars, he had his women. Yeah, and, you know, it's really interesting. And the other interesting thing, I think, that you'll find in this story is Barron. Now, I know Barron likes to keep low-key, but Barron Perez ran an auto body shop with hubcaps.
Car stereos.
Hubcaps.
Best car stereos in New York.
I'm mixing up Betrayal in Blue with The Wire. you know, this guy's auto stereo shop is the top auto stereo shop in New York City. And, you know, it's the place Adam likes a certain kind of music. He goes and gets his cars done there.
Hello, George Michael.
Yeah, George.
Not just Adam. That's how, actually, we came involved with everything, because Perez is a very diplomatic, again, type businessman, and he likes to smooth things out with everybody. And what we recognized was all the drug dealers were spending cash money at his place. And that's how we hooked up with Perez, who then hooked us up with two different drug organizations, Cello and La Compañía, and Diaz and his organization.
And Barron, you know, is just a great interview. He, you know, adds a lot of color to the book, and, you know, it color that
authenticity.
Authenticity.
It's like the scars in leather that come from the barbed wire. If it's smooth and there's no scars, you know it's not real leather. You know, if it's got the scars on it, this is real leather.
Yeah, that's good. But that's true. And, I mean, to have lived in Brooklyn at that time and still be here today really says something about the grit of, you know, the individual. And I think that's, you know, Adam brings a lot of that authenticity to it. Wouldn't you agree, Ken?
Make up these characters if you were writing a fictional book.
That's true.
That's how real we are. I shouldn't say we. Them more so than myself and Dowd.
That's like Chicky and the other guy, the Lurch. The big, huge guy.
Oh, Walter.
Yeah, Walter.
Walter Yerku.
You ran.
And then you got guys like Bubba, you know, who was murdering people so he could get a rock of coke.
And you can't make these people up. You know, and Walter's story is, I mean, amazing. The guy is on his way to work. He stops at a bodega and robs it. Tell the rest of the story, Ken.
Maybe he doesn't. Which story is that?
The R&T grocery
run. Right, yeah.
This is going back to, again, prior to our arrest. It's like 4 years prior to our arrest. And I think it was July of '88. He went into a tour. He actually invited me to go on this robbery with him, and I turned him down. This was after Dowd had left, and Yerku came up to me that morning. He goes, "We're going to go hit a place tonight. Do you want to join us?" And Dowd was gone. I was like, sort of relieved that I'm not involved in this shit no more. I was getting back to being a regular cop, and I said, "No, thanks. You know, I know it's time to quit." Sort of like what happened towards the end of '92, I was trying to get out of the cocaine business before we got arrested. But he goes in with two other cops, probably around 10 o'clock at night. They rob the bodega, which is just a front for drug sales, take a whole bunch of money and drugs from the guy, and they kidnap the guy and start riding him around the precinct, I'm assuming, looking for another drug location or maybe his house and see if there's more money there. But what happens is they end up letting him go, and they're guy, they had robbed this guy once prior to this. So the guy, like, at this point, you know, we always say, well, if you rob somebody of drugs and money, what are they going to do, report it? They're just happy. Well, this is the second time they robbed the guy. So the guy said, fuck this. He went to the precinct to report it, that the guys were posing as police officers. He don't know if they're real police officers, and he got robbed. So while he's reporting at the precinct, York U reports for work at midnight, and he's a standout character. He's not like he's blended in. He's more, a couple of hundred pounds, and he had red hair at the time. And the guy's like, there he is. There's the guy who robbed me.
And when they looked at, and he had a very unique car, right? And
I think it was an old Lincoln or an old Cadillac.
It's like a sky blue, Lincoln Continental. And when they go, and look at the car, here's the proceeds from the R&T robbery.
Everything was sitting right there in the car.
It's,
so what happened?
Well, needless to say, Walter's not on the force anymore.
Yeah, he was fired and he went to prison for, I think, 2 years.
See, I thought maybe they just kind of turned around to the guy and said, you must have the wrong guy.
Well, the thing is, so this gets, I think,
he probably could have got away with it wasn't me if he didn't have the proceeds of the stuff in his car.
Exactly.
It's just another 6'4" red-headed cop in a powder blue Lincoln.
I think he had a stolen police radio in the car, too. Portable radio.
Well, that way they could listen in and make sure that nobody was, coming into
exactly,
their...
Which is the smart thing. You're working in your precinct, you could listen to the calls that's going on while you're robbing someone.
Right. So... Now, Kent, the fact of the matter is that NYPD didn't want anyone to really know that this stuff was going on, right?
Prior to this was the 7/7 scandal, which made a big hit in the paper. That's where I originally was working before I went to the 7/5. And I think there were 13 cops at the time there arrested, and rumors were flying back and forth that the 7/5 was going to have the same scandal. And the bosses kept, no, put it down. And all these complaints, I guess, that were coming in, we found out after my arrest, it was like 13 complaints, I think, lodged against Dowd and a few against me. And they just, it's unfounded, sweep it under the rug. They didn't want the public embarrassment.
No, it's so like
they let the cancer spread.
Yeah, it's like a girl who has the clap and won't tell anybody because it'll ruin her reputation.
More and more cops kept getting drawn into to what was going on.
So how high up did the corruption go in your precinct?
I can't say.
You can't. I got to tell you, Ken, the guy asked you this question worked on the Ramparts scandal. So he already knew the answer to that. You can't tell him. You can't say anything above you.
There were no bosses directly involved with anything that I did.
No, I think the more crucial thing is that the bosses looked the other way.
Exactly.
I think you highlighted this, Ken.
We have it in the book where I was driving a boss and Dowd called me over the radio to meet him, and he handed me envelope stuff full of cash right in front of the boss. And the boss didn't say a word. So,
and the reason is because the 7/7 scandal was scandalous.
Yeah, we don't want any more of those scandals.
And a police officer committed suicide when this scandal was exposed. And they had a new commissioner who did not want to be associated with a corrupt New York City Police Department. And rather than root out corruption, he turned the other way.
Same today.
Chief Bratton, or now former Commissioner Bratton, was either associated with the NYPD at that time or came in right after Ken left. And, there's a recent scandal in the NYPD, not as deep as the 7/5 or what happened in the 7/7, but it's interesting to me how the same cast of brass has rotated in and out of the department at about the same times these scandals are coming and going. Wouldn't you agree, Ken?
What they say is every 20 years the cycle starts again. So it was 92, we got arrested, 2012. I guess that all started hitting in, these next last couple of years.
Right. And it's the same kind of stuff. I mean, nobody's on, it's not people on the pad anymore, but there's different ways to make money on your beat and in your precinct.
Any cop who can't do that isn't worth the uniform. How do you like that for an encouraging comment?
Would but I think Ken, like we started this out, I think Ken would disagree with you. I think that, you know, I mean, the way that we started this whole conversation out is, do you regret it? And I think Ken, right? You wish
absolutely. I would have loved to gone through my career as a, you know, a good cop and retire a hero detective like the guys I worked with. You know, a lot of my friends are retired detectives, sergeants, Essex. We're talking about. I think he's still on the job. I know he was still on the job after 30 years, and he was a captain. If has he retired since then? I don't know. I mean, 30 years would have been 2011. So I don't know if he's still on the job, but he made it up to the rank of captain.
Do you ever think about taking your experiences to an academy, a police academy, and, you know, a little cautionary visit?
After I was arrested, that was actually supposed to be part of the plea deal I made, that I was supposed to, it's in my... It's in my closing paperwork from...
I will tell you from...
And I was supposed to go back to the police academy eventually and give classes.
Based on the research...
It never came to fruition. I don't know what happened.
Ken, you don't have to worry about that. The research for this book, I discovered that at the police academy, you and Mike are not only well-known, your case well-known,
absolutely.
Unfortunately, you're role models. There are people...
Across the country have been talking about our case. Since it broke in 92. I mean,
there are people who have joined the police force because they want to be you.
You in the academy.
Oh, chili pimping in Atlantic City.
Yeah. I got to tell you, don't mention any names here, but in the book, we mentioned towards the end about the continual cycle, as you were talking about, of reforms, and then it comes out again, and then more reforms. The... Giuliani, 94, appointed William Bratton as commissioner. Bratton set about enacting reforms. Quote, "That's bullshit," countered a former NYPD officer who was on the force during those years. Giuliani encouraged corruption. Anyone who says otherwise is full of shit. Any New York cop with an ounce of honesty about dishonesty knows Giuliani's attitude towards corruption. Quote, "Do whatever you can get away with. Just don't get caught. That's no big secret." The same individual was telling me about police escorts escorting drugs from New Jersey to New York, you know, with the like you're delivering to the bank or something.
That's exactly what we used to do back then with Diaz.
Yep, same being done now. And then...
You know, and maybe this has something to do with Giuliani suddenly dropping out of the Secretary of State.
I just heard that today on the news.
Yeah. I mean... You know, it was awful sudden, and
the police union in New York is no big fan of his anyway. You saw the giant ad they took out in the New York papers a couple months ago.
Well, there you go.
The union's not happy with him at all.
How about the NYPD? Now. Have you heard from anybody that's on the force now, telling you, like, hey, you know, we don't want to relive this. We don't want to bring this back up. We're tired of the story.
No. Anyone current now, I really have no contact with. All the people I meet are retired cops who, you know, they either hate me or love me. They wanted to be there doing what we were doing, or they're totally the opposite way, and, you know, you guys were scumbags and lowlives.
Yeah, well,
both are
true.
No in between, really. It's a love or hate.
It's a love or hate situation. But when you were, you know, when you were starting out and you were in the academy, though, a lot of this stuff, the behaviors, the blue wall, was learned stuff, right? I mean, even in the academy.
Absolutely. You become so close with these people, you know, working day in and day out with them in the academy. You know, first of all, for me, it was really easy, and for the guys I came on with, it was really easy. We're 20 years old. We still had good study habits. We're in good shape. So it was sort of a breeze. It was like going back through high school. But there were other guys who came on the job. They're in their early 30s. They had families and mortgages, and here they are. You know, they threw away high-paying jobs to do this. They really struggled and had a hard time doing it. But you became so tight with everybody, you don't want to, you know, say nothing bad about nobody. You see them doing something that weak. And the instructors at the time, and they stopped it after one of our outings was a Friday night. and we all going out in the academy, and the instructors went out drinking with us. One of the instructors for the gym.
And, went out drinking with you.
Exactly.
Fraternizing.
Exactly. And it wasn't frowned upon, but certainly after the situation it was, because he got so drunk we had to carry him home. Because that's who was living in the city, to his apartment, and he was passed out there and didn't make it to work.
Well, you talk a little bit about that, in your memoir, where you talk about, going out after you get your gun, and it's, you've got it basically on your hip, and bouncers and bars are afraid of you, and
again, a drunk 20-year-old with a four-inch barrel Smith & Wesson hanging out his backside, it wasn't the best situation.
And you just told him, well, hey, I'm a cop.
What happened was the bouncer came up to me and said, oh, I could see your gun. We're going to call the cops. He didn't know we were cops. I said, we are the cops, my man.
My man.
Slightly less drunk than I was, took my gun. They took the bullets out, and then they gave me back my gun. And I'm like, gee, thanks a lot. What happens if something happens? I got a gun with no bullets in it.
Yeah, that's always the guy with the gun that gets the bullets hanging out always says that.
Yeah. So
thanks a lot.
They dumped me off at an apartment in the city, the same apartment they dropped this instructor off at previously. And then they went back out partying, and then they came back to the apartment, crashed out drunk. Three guys fell out in the hallway because two guys in the apartment were too drunk to answer the door when they came home. The drink is actually brings everyone closer together, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, jeez.
So, yes, it does. And so does the Penthouse Forum. Back in the 70s, there was Penthouse Forum. Penthouse Magazine, as you know, is a...
I had a dear friend who used to write the letters.
For the Penthouse Forum.
Yeah. This is a problem my wife has now. The fact that I brought this up in a book. We just talked about it today.
Oh. Okay, sorry,
Dory. Penthouse Forum?
We'll stop here.
We'll stop about the... No, but it's just true. Alan Goldblatt, my close personal friend, Billboard award-winning producer, used to write the letters. The letters to the editor, like, I got a question, my horrible situation. Yeah, they're fake. He used to write them.
I think it's 75. You know what? We used to think... So, when you're in junior high school and high school and you read those, you think, this has got to be fake.
It is.
It can't be real.
It is fake.
Now I know.
Yeah, I'm a tree sloth with eight legs.
Yeah.
And this gorgeous girl came up to me.
Yeah. Can you give me some advice?
What happened to me could have actually been a letter.
Good that one of Burl's friends wrote. Wow, my head is spinning now.
Alec probably wrote it.
Oh, boy.
Second in a patrol car. Yeah, I think that's a letter for Penthouse Forum.
I like the women dancing on the hood of the car. How did they avoid the flashing lights?
I don't know. I wasn't there for that one. I only seen pictures of it.
In Chicky's part of the book, he talks a lot about, that kind of stuff where there was I don't know if you call it a clubhouse or a hangout or a place where everybody went. Like in the Choir Boys. You remember Wambaugh book,
exactly,
The Choir Boys?
Mm, Onion Field.
And, the guys would go and hang out there after their shift and drink and fire off their weapons. And
Stoop.
I love the... I think it was Chicky that was telling me how they would get loads of fireworks and go down there and pop them off.
That was me. He might have had a similar one, yeah.
You did that too, though, right?
Yeah, it was, I think, the first year we were in the 7-5.
What did you do? You took fireworks from...
It was the 4th of July, and we had three squad cars. We were working a midnight tour, and they just... All three of us just rode around the precinct collecting fireworks from the... people shooting them off in the neighborhood, and instead of either throwing them in the trash or you're supposed to voucher them, it would have took us probably 3 years to voucher them all. We had three squad cars full of fireworks. We went all the way down to the end of the pier, down by Starrett City on the other side of Belt Parkway. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning, and we started shooting off all fireworks.
It's just awesome. See, this was a good life. So now what about the Starrett City actually figures fairly big in the book, right?
Yeah, well, that's where the local bar was, the hangout, Bailey's Bar, which was owned by a housing cop. We used to go there on duty, drink for free, and sometimes there would the guys would get together there, plan their little raids and robberies. So yeah, that figures prominently into the book.
You also had you had an interesting call, I think, at Star City, right, with a couple of brothers.
Yeah, there was. This was all prior to Dow. This is just regular police work type stuff. We went to a scene of shots fired in Star City. It was probably up on the 10th floor. It was one of these high-rise buildings. And we get there, and there's these two teenage boys, brothers, and there's a hole in the wall. They shot a rifle. They were playing with their father's guns through the wall that went into the apartment next door and lodged right above a baby's crib. So actually what happened was the parents from next door had called, and then we went back over and met the brothers. So what we did, we ended up taking them to Spofford. We vouched all the guns, turned all the guns in. And as we were dropping them off at Spofford, me and my partner were saying to each other, one day one of these kids are going to kill another person. So probably 2 years later, 3 years later, call again, comes over, shots fired. I recognize the address. We go racing over there, and one of the kids did kill somebody. He shot his own brother in the chest and killed him.
And I think this is, I mean, I think that underlying all the, you know, the coke and the robbery and all the, like, crap that's going on, I mean, this is the day-to-day life in the 7-5. It's a lot of bad stuff, right, Ken?
Yeah. My gun was out every day, and not just, like, once a tour, like, probably 10 times a tour. You're getting calls constantly for shootings, murders, confirmed shootings, confirmed murders. And, it was just running from one end of the precinct to another.
Well, Ken...
You work a busy 4 to 12. Sometimes you handle 20, 25 jobs in a tour, in an 8-hour tour.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, my time last night, they were running the movie The Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel.
Excellent movie.
Well, in 1994, I was in New York for the Edgar Awards, I'm proud to say, and kind of made friends with a guy who was in the NYPD, who was an aspiring author. I don't know if he ever became one or not, but I happened to mention that film to him. He goes, great film. He says, but, you know, back at the precinct, we don't call it The Bad Lieutenant. We just call it The Lieutenant. Which I thought was kind of cool. We just call it The Lieutenant.
Hey, Louie.
So buy the book. Maybe we should make out. I just bit my tongue. Should mention the name of the book so people can buy numerous copies for
right,
the holidays.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Betrayal in Blue, the shocking memoir of the scandal that rocked the NYPD. Story behind the documentary The 7-5, written by brilliant Burl Bear, Frank C. Girardo Jr., and our guest Ken Urell. And of course, he had no fear of the cops because
he was the cops.
They were the cops. And this book will clear up one of the most important little bits of misinformation.
Well, I have a cream for that if you want.
Well, you want misinformation?
No, to clear that up.
Yeah, let's clear that up. Watching the 7-5, which I've done several times, at the end, you get this distorted impression that Ken rolled over, shall we say, on Michael, cooperated on getting Michael busted to avoid going to jail. Bullshit. That is not what happened.
Really?
And the fact that it gives that impression pisses me off. Because if you pay close attention to what's actually said in the documentary, it belies that. In the book, it's made even more clear. They were both arrested the same night. They were both out on bail. Ken saying, hey, man, we did the crime. We should just do the time and get it over with. And Mike saying, got a plan. I got a plan. If I could just stop sweating long enough, I'll tell you the plan. Wipe the perspiration out of my eyes, and I'll tell you, we're going to kidnap a woman whose dead husband owed the Colombians some drug money, and we'll turn her over for execution. In return for that, they'll smuggle us to Nicaragua. We'll work on a shrimp boat. What do you say, pal? You in? Fuck no. I mean...
No, I told him fuck no about 100 times. Let's put it like this. Typical my ex-partner, he never accepted no.
Well, to me, and I know this is weird sounding, but to me it was Sophie's choice in a squad car. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you didn't cooperate with the feds regarding your partner, most likely he'd be dead. The Colombians would have killed him. If he was lucky enough to escape that, the feds would send him away for 25 to life. So either you had a choice. You could save your partner's life, or you can cooperate with the feds. You know, if you cooperate with your
friends.
Which
is the same choice.
Yeah, it's the same choice.
Right.
If you don't, if you stick with him, you'll probably both be dead. At least if he went off to do it himself, he'd be dead.
The fucked up part is if he would have seen the writing on the wall, the first time I got called into the feds, I actually told him, Mike, I'm getting called into the feds. I got to go see what they want. My lawyer said we have to go in. And when I got back from that meeting, he was practically waiting on my doorstep to find out what happened. So he knows all about the feds are involved. I told him they were already in contact with me. It's when I went back in a second time, because he wouldn't stop with this fucking escape plan to Central America, that I had to do it. That's it. Once I told my lawyer what was going on, he was like, that's it, you have to cooperate.
It's insane.
The Forrest Dowd escape plan. Barbecue shrimp, shrimp on a boat, shrimp po' boy, shrimp sandwich, shrimp on a stick.
It's like chocolate.
Well, if people want to give you a bad time, you say, just tell them, would you rather let my partner get killed? You know, there's a choice. There's your choice for you. I could save his life or not save his life. So there you are. Anyway, buy several copies of the book. And for one of the first times in the history of literature, you can get the paperback, the ebook, and the audiobook all at the same time.
For one special price?
Well, yeah, probably, if you lump them all together.
You got to figure out how to do that. But that is true. It is.
That's music.
Okay, that's awesome. That's applause.
Well, that's applause.
Yeah.
I just thought it was distortion.
That's applause. You know, I got to say this about the audiobook. Just listening to Kevin Pierce read the chapter where Dory is confronting the SWAT team in her house made me want to read the book.
And you wrote it. He does do a great job, and the introduction by Burl Bear is priceless. I didn't pay a cent for it. Thank you, Ken Urell.
Ken, you're awesome. Say hi to Dory for me.
Thanks a lot for coming
on. My pleasure.
Hey, Burl.
Wow.
What's next?
Magic Matt Allen and the Demons of Decadence is live in the Lightning Lounge. Outlaw Radio, USA.